Welcome to Community News, covering the towns of Marlboro, Hudson, Harvard, Stowe, and Bolton. This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. This program is sponsored in part by the Lions Clubs of Ashland, Bolton, and Harvard, and thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, I will be bringing you news from the Marlboro Hudson Community Advocate, July 10th edition, and the Stowe and Bolton Independent, July 16th edition. No Harvard Press this week. This is Bob Brady reading to you live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. I'm going to start us off with articles from the Marlboro Hudson Community Advocate. In an effort to attract new business, the Hudson Select Board unanimously agreed to create approximately 12 additional liquor licenses. The town has only a few licenses, all alcohol, beer and wine, and package store licenses, available and is running up against its limit. The few available licenses are mostly restricted for the shops at Highland Commons, located more than a mile west of downtown Hudson. In a memo to the town manager, Business Improvement District Administrator Richard Braga said that the BID is aware of several prospective restaurant operators who have expressed interest in opening establishments in downtown Hudson, but have been discouraged upon learning that no liquor licenses are currently available. Braga said removing that barrier would spur new investment. The proposal would add 6 new all-alcohol licenses, 4 reserved for the Business Improvement District, and 2 that could be used anywhere in Hudson. It would also add 6 new beer and wine licenses with the same split. The move requires more than just the Select Board's approval. It would have to get past town meeting, where a majority vote would be required. From there, a home rule petition would be filed with the Massachusetts House of Representatives. If it passes, then the Senate takes it up, and if it's successful there, the bill would go to Governor Maura Healey. The Select Board Chair, Stephen Sharrock, supported the plan. Downtown Hudson has built a reputation for having good restaurants, and we need to continue to support that, he told the Community Advocate. The Select Board will bring the issue to town meeting for its consideration in November. Assuming town meeting approves, we will immediately ask State Representative Kate Hogan to file a bill to authorize the additional licenses, said Sharrock. He said Hogan knows that this is a priority for Hudson and is sure she'll work hard to get the bill through the House. Select Board Vice Chair Lauren DeBrule said she also supports the effort to strengthen our local economy and recognize that additional liquor licenses can help attract new investment and support the continued success of Hudson's downtown businesses. A vibrant downtown benefits our entire community, she said. She added she wants the conversation to include the Board of Health. I am confident that by bringing together the Business Improvement District, the Board of Health, public safety officials, and community stakeholders, we can support a thriving downtown while continuing to prioritize the health, safety, and well-being of our residents, DeBrule said. As for timing, Sharrock said that it's almost impossible to predict how long it will take any bill to pass, but the hope is that it will be a quick process. Massachusetts started imposing population-based limits on liquor licenses in 1933 after the repeal of Prohibition. Brian Bowen wins Babe Ruth National Award by Evan Walsh. Brian Bowen is one in a million. Actually, he's better than that. Of the 1.9 million Babe Ruth League volunteers across the United States, Bowen was selected as the recipient of the 2026 Lefty Gomez Volunteer of the Year Award, the honor given to one person nationwide, recognizes the dedication and commitment of a volunteer that contributes to the growth and success of youth. Your unwavering dedication has left an indelible mark on the Babe Ruth program, and your contributions have been invaluable. We sincerely thank you for your generosity of time, tireless commitment, and deep passion for serving both the youth and volunteers of our program, said Steve Tellefson, the president of the Babe Ruth League. It is individuals like you who go above and beyond year after year that create a truly special experience for our softball families. Added Bowen, it's pretty emotional, to be honest with you. I was so humbled and appreciative. Bowen's involvement with Hudson Youth Sports began 30 years ago. In 1996, he offered to be a parent volunteer for a T-ball team. The next day, a bag of baseball equipment was dropped on his doorstep. That was the start of his decades-long tenure. He was officially involved in Hudson Athletics. In 2002, he started his first stint as the president of Hudson Youth Baseball and Softball, leading the development of Boutwell Field on Chapin Road. He's a man with deep Hudson connections. His father, one of the founders of Hudson Youth Hockey, won a state championship in town. His son, Ryan, coaches the Hudson Post 100 baseball team. And his niece, Laura, coaches Hudson softball. He is also the vice president of the R.F. Wood Foundation and the chair of the Hudson Board of Assessors. Hudson through and through, giving the town's kids an excellent experience is a matter of pride for Bowen. Being third generation, having the legacy of my dad playing, my kids playing, it matters. Maintaining the fields that my dad played on, my son played on, it's personal, he told the community advocate. Just to be considered for this award, it's amazing. And though he's incredibly respected by the Hudson community, Bowen also completes the work that's not often celebrated. He's dragging the infield before 9 a.m. T-ball games, managing tournaments, coordinating volunteers, and creating a lasting impact on generations of players and families. Since 2006, he served as Babe Ruth's Western Massachusetts District Commissioner. It's really a labor of love, he said. Though he does so much, he credits the volunteers for the league's success. You don't do what I do without help. We have 43 teams, 86 coaches, and board members. Nobody gets paid. Most people do it because they have kids in the program. And now the kids I've coached are now having kids, said Bowen. It's been really special. New Horizons at Marlboro selects resident care partner. New Horizons at Marlboro has selected Right at Home Boston Metro West as its new resident care partner. Through the new partnership, which begins October 1st, Right at Home will provide and manage all nursing and personal care services for residents in New Horizons assisted living and memory care programs. Its caregivers will also provide supportive care services for residents throughout the retirement community. New Horizons at Marlboro is clearly more than a place to live. It is a vibrant community where residents are supported, engaged, and known, said Vladimir Zarkin, president of Right at Home Boston Metro West. Its broad activities, specialized support programs, and caring team reflect a deep commitment to quality of life. We are proud to partner with New Horizons and bring our own commitment to service, excellence, to help residents remain safe, comfortable, and connected as their needs evolve. Based in Newton, Right at Home Boston Metro West has served older adults and their families throughout Metro West and Greater Boston for nearly 25 years. The organization has earned Caring Star recognition from National Senior Living Advisor Caring.com each year from 2021 through 2026, and was designated a Caring Superstar in 2026 for its consistent positive consumer ratings and reviews. We are pleased to partner with an organization that shares our commitment to compassionate, person-centered care, said Betsy Connolly, Executive Director of New Horizons at Marlboro. New Horizons at Marlboro offers a continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, memory care, respite stays, and an on-site geriatric psych program. In recent years, the community introduced special diabetes assistance and Parkinson's support programs. Our priority is ensuring residents have the appropriate level of support as their needs change, said Connolly. Given its outstanding reputation, extensive experience, and dedication to service excellence, we are confident that Right at Home will be an ideal partner in this work. And now from the Marlboro Regional Chamber of Commerce, the power of partnership in the Marlboro region. A strong business community isn't built by one company alone. It's built through collaboration. Here in the Marlboro region, businesses of every size play an essential role in creating a thriving local economy. Our small businesses bring innovation, character, and personalized service, while our larger employers drive investment, create career opportunities, and strengthen our workforce. Together, they form an ecosystem that benefits us all. The Marlboro Regional Chamber of Commerce is proud to serve as the bridge that brings these businesses together. Through networking events, partnerships, educational programs, and community initiatives, we create opportunities for meaningful connections that fuel growth and innovation. When businesses support one another, everyone wins. Together, we're building a stronger, more resilient Marlboro region, one relationship, one partnership, and one success story at a time. Marlboro PD to hold National Night Out. The Marlboro Police Department invites the community to First Lieutenant Charles W. Whitcomb School from 5 to 8 p.m. on August 4th. It's an event for all ages that includes food trucks, displays from community organizations, and much more. It's an opportunity to interact with law enforcement officers in a comfortable, fun setting. Come for the activities, stay for the Dunk a Cop. And now I have a public service announcement to read. The Worcester Public Library announced the opening of an interactive tactile exhibit at its main branch at 3 Salem Square from July 15th through August 15th. Created by Tactile Images, the exhibit uses patented technology that transforms iconic works of art into three-dimensional tactile renderings, allowing visitors to experience visual information through touch. The exhibit's design, in part, makes visual art more accessible to the blind or visually impaired. The exhibit, Seven Arts Movements, examines the evolution of history's art movements through tactile reproductions of works by renowned artists, including Leonardo da Vinci, Johannes Vermeer, and Vincent van Gogh. It also explores stylistic characteristics of the Renaissance, Baroque, Neoclassicism, Impressionism, Post-Impressionism, Art Nouveau, and Expressionism. The exhibit features seven tactile images, each paired with a corresponding fine art print. The Worcester Talking Book Library is committed to ensuring that everyone has access to educational and cultural experiences, said Lee Ann Hooley, head of WTBL. This exhibit offers a unique opportunity for individuals who are blind or visually impaired to engage with art in a meaningful way while helping sighted visitors gain a deeper appreciation for accessible design and inclusive programming. Once again, the Worcester Public Library announced the opening of an interactive tactile exhibit at its main branch at 3 Salem Square from July 15th to August 15th. And now let's take a break for another public service announcement, and then I'll be back with more news.
Would you like to hear news from Barry and Spencer that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune in to Audio Journal every Monday at 6 p.m.
This is Bob Brady back with Audio Journal. The time is 3:16, and now I've got articles from the Stowe and Bolton Independent. Town Rings in 250 Years by Kristen Dijon. Towns and cities around the state have been celebrating America's 250th anniversary. On display at the Bolton Public Library throughout the month of July, the town clerk's recording of the Declaration of Independence. In Stowe, residents gathered July 4th to help the Stowe Historical Society ring the town's historic Paul Revere bell 250 times. The 9-minute ceremony held at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in the Assabet Valley, formerly First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton, invited all ages to take turns pulling the bell rope to commemorate the anniversary. Copies of the Declaration of Independence were also distributed. The bell, cast by P. Revere and Sons in 1827, has been part of Stowe's history for nearly two centuries. According to the First Parish Church Unitarian Universalist of Stowe and Acton, a brief history, the bell was purchased after Abigail Eveleth pledged $400 toward its cost while the town's fourth meeting house was under construction. Eveleth died before the church was dedicated, and the bell was first rung at her funeral in September 1827. Following the adoption of the Declaration of Independence, Massachusetts officials directed that copies be read aloud in every parish and permanently recorded in each town's official record book. In Bolton, Town Clerk Nathaniel Longley carefully transcribed the declaration into the town records, creating a lasting historical record that has been preserved as a memorial to the nation's founding. It's on display at the Bolton Public Library through July. Sizing Up Wells During Drought by Kristen Dijon with Elizabeth Schopke. Even the recent 1-plus inch of rainfall did not ease the ongoing drought conditions, noted Elizabeth Schopke, a well specialist with H2O Care of Stowe. As a longtime chief knowledge/technology officer at Safewell of Bolton, which is now part of H2O Care, Schopke has more than a decade of experience working with local wells. She points to a mass.gov statement addressing last week's heavy rains. Central Massachusetts, Worcester County, is currently experiencing a level 2 significant drought, with rainfall deficits ranging from 4 to 6 inches below normal over the last few months. While recent scattered downpours have offered some temporary moisture, long-term hydrological and groundwater deficits persist across the region. Though next to each other, Bolton is in the Central Mass region and Stowe in the Northeast region, which remains in a level 3 critical drought. The Mass.gov July 9th drought status map continues to show both towns are in significant or critical drought despite the heavy rains on July 6th through 7th. According to Schottky and others, some wells are at greater risk of failure. In this independent Q&A, Schottky explains aquifers, well depth, and what well owners should watch for. Explain the water source or sources for local wells. Most of the wells in our area are drilled wells, typically 6 inches in diameter. Wells are typically drilled to depths of from 100 to 500 feet, but can be deeper depending on where the driller finds the most reliable, high-yield aquifer. An aquifer is not a big pool of water your well pulls from. Water from rain or snow filters through soil, sand, and rock and collects in porous bedrock, in cracks or fractures. Some wells, however, are shallow wells, often less than 100 feet deep and typically 36 inches in diameter, with a concrete cover. Shallow wells are very susceptible to surface water contamination, such as bacteria, fertilizers, and pesticides, as well as from chemicals discharged from industrial operations. They are also much more susceptible to drought because they rely on the surface water table that fluctuates with rainfall levels. Boards of health prohibit digging or installing new shallow wells, but existing shallow wells are basically not regulated. How much rain will it take to replenish local aquifers? Depending on the soil and geology of your well is drilled in, it can take days to years to replenish an aquifer. How can residents check to see the depth of their well? Your Board of Health might have records of your well depth. The Massachusetts Energy and Environmental Affairs data portal also has a well drilling section where you can look up well depths by town and street. Unfortunately, we have found this database to be hit or miss. What's the best way to use the Energy and Environmental Affairs well drilling data portal? Choose the town, well type equals domestic, and click search. Once the system shows all the wells, click on street name to sort alphabetically A to Z, or click again to resort Z to A, then click the forward button until you reach your street name and look up your street number. If you don't see your street number and there are wells identified on your street with no street number, you could click each one and see if it is identified by a lot number or lat longe coordinates. It can be a lot of work to match lat longe coordinates to your address or a lot number if you know which your house was before it was assigned a number, but one of these could be yours. If you don't see your address in the data portal, is there an ID tag on the wellhead? There won't typically be an ID tag on your wellhead. However, your Board of Health may have a copy of your well completion report. As a last resort, you can try contacting the driller who drilled your well, but most people don't have that information. Is there a way to monitor current water levels for a particular well? It is possible to measure the static water level, resting water level before pumping water out, using a sonar device. But I'm not sure what value there is in tracking that level regularly, only to know it's lower or higher than last time. What are the signs that a well may be failing? The most obvious symptom that a well may be failing is a sudden drop in water pressure during periods of peak demand. For example, morning showers, dishwashing, etc., or just generally. If the water level in your well gets low and close enough to the well pump, the pump can strain, and you might hear the pressure tank, typically in the basement, clicking on and off. That's called short cycling and is a sign that the well pump is struggling to pull water. You might also get air in the water lines, which spits as you're trying to draw water from a faucet. What does drought do to water quality? Because the available water volume is lower, the minerals that are naturally in water will concentrate. If you naturally have nitrate, arsenic, and manganese in your water, when they concentrate, the levels go up and can increase the related health risks. Iron and manganese can also cause nuisance staining as well as a metallic taste to the water. News and more from Stowe. Common road traffic patterns addressed at Stowe Select Board meeting by Melissa Rollins. The Stowe Select Board meeting on July 14th began with a brief report from the town administrator Denise Demkoski reminding Stowe residents that the town building closes at noon on Friday and that any items that have deadlines of Friday must be delivered by noon. Demkoski also reported that the fire department finally received a new ambulance that was approved at a 2023 town meeting and that a third cistern for fire suppression has been funded by efforts through Representative Kate Hogan. Appointments. Continuing with agenda items, the Select Board unanimously voted to approve appointments to the Zoning Board of Daniel Rowley as DPW Director and Ryan Butler conditionally to the position of firefighter/EMT through June 30th, 2027. Randall Library Friends donation. The Select Board unanimously voted to accept the donation of $214,000 from the Randall Library Friends Association for furnishing the newly renovated Randall Library. This donation was raised through fundraising efforts of the Revitalize Randall Subcommittee. In a letter to the Randall Friends accepting the donation, J.T. Toole expressed the town's appreciation, saying, "We recognize that this remarkable gift is the result of years of fundraising, volunteerism, and steadfast support of your members, donors, and the broader community. Your partnership with the town and the library has been invaluable, and this donation stands as a lasting legacy to your commitment to enriching the lives of Stowe residents." License approvals. The board then went on to grant a one-day liquor license to the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in the Aspen Valley, UU Church, for their annual craft beer and food truck festival taking place on Saturday, September 5th. Live music was approved, Common Road will be closed off, and Parking Stowe Town Building was also approved. FLIK International Corp. has applied for a license to serve food at Masters Academy. All appropriate documents were received, and the Select Board unanimously approved the license. Town Center Improvement Project. Town Planning Director Valerie Orthoise presented an update on the Town Center Streetscape Improvement Project. Orthoise explained in a memo to the board that pedestrian, bike, and vehicular traffic and traffic signals were all part of the evaluation. While the traffic study has not specifically included Common Road, the number of vehicles traveling in each direction in a 24-hour period was measured. About 500 vehicles traveled northwest along Common Road, that is, entering from Great Road near the UU Church and exiting onto Library Hill Road. Only one vehicle traveled southeast from Library Hill Road onto Common Road and then onto Great Road. Orthoise explained that the engineers are waiting to move forward until the Select Board makes a final decision on Common Road. Questions were raised regarding the expense that would be involved to convert Common Road back to a two-way street at a future date. Demkoski indicated that the process will be extensive and expensive. The board ultimately decided to use money budgeted for the study to also include evaluating various traffic patterns on Common Road. Orthoid was also asked to have the engineers evaluate options to make the left turn from Great Road onto Common Road less difficult, such as modifying the angle of the intersection and/or adding a dedicated lane on Great Road. Now let's listen to another public service announcement, and then I'll be back with more news. This is Bob Brady back with Audio Journal. The time is 3:31. I'm going to continue with the Independent of Stowe and Bolton. Work to begin on mural with drop-in painting day by Kristen Dijon in conversation with Katerina Romano. A Girl Scout Gold Award project has turned into a chance for the community to come together and create a lasting and meaningful piece of art. The goal of the Stowe Local History Mural Project will be turning an unattractive concrete wall on Hartley Road near Center School into a meaningful and colorful reminder of Stowe's history, featuring landmarks such as Gleasondale Mill, Lake Boone, apple orchards, and golf courses. Originally, the project was planned for July 18th, but due to rain in the forecast, Romano decided to delay the project by a week. The new date is set for July 25th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It will take place on Hartley Road, parking behind Center School. There will be drop-in mural painting and family activities. The design, quilt-inspired, and paint-by-number encourages community involvement. This is a drop-in event, and all are encouraged to stop by. While not required, the following RSVP link has been created so Romano can track interest. And it's a little too long. tinyurl.com/Mural Painting Day RSVP at Stowe Gold Award Mural Project. In this independent conversation, we hear more about the project from event manager and designer Katerina Romano. What first gave you the idea of a community mural? The idea for my mural initially came from a public art activity I participated in one of my first robotics competitions, where participants painted small canvases that were later assembled into a large mosaic mural. Visiting places like Houston, Texas, which has nearly 1,000 murals across the city, has also helped me see how much of an impact public art can have by brightening a space and making complex topics more approachable. In addition, I've always enjoyed learning about history, but have noticed that much of Stowe's history isn't very visible or accessible in everyday life. I wanted to combine all these interests while also challenging myself with a project that would push me a bit outside my comfort zone. Explain the Girl Scout Gold Award and why the mural fits the stated goal of the award. The Girl Scout Gold Award is the highest award in Girl Scouting and can be earned by Girl Scout seniors and ambassadors, grades 9 through 12. It involves a take action project to address a specific community issue that continues to make an impact after it is completed. My project aims to make Stowe's history more engaging and accessible while also fostering a sense of pride and our town's heritage. In addition to creating the physical artwork, I will be making educational resources that connect to the elements depicted in the mural. American Heritage Museum launches monthly program with Van of Valor book presentation by Christopher DeLisso. Patriotism, resilience, and compelling storytelling were in the air on July 2nd at the American Heritage Museum, where a curious local audience braved the evening heat to learn about Van of Valor. Ballast Books 2026. This new collection of oral histories about veterans living and past is the work of two authors, the intrepid Wallace couple, who in 2025 traveled some 27,000 miles across 48 states in 280 days. Their mission was to document unknown stories of veterans from conflicts as far back as Korea and Vietnam, and as recent as Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Middle East. The just-released book is the first step in what should become an important addition to the American Military History Archives. At the event, the authors were introduced by Mark Fucaril, a 2013 Boston Marathon bombing survivor. His gripping story of surviving the traumas of terrorism and long recovery after losing his right leg left the audience moved. Fucarilli, who recounted that Marine Corps amputees were among his first hospital visitors, noted the uncanny serendipity of the present moment. Just 2 days before America's 250th anniversary, his son had shipped out to Navy boot camp, having been inspired towards military service partially by his father's traumatic experience and a visit with him to a World War II reenactment at the American Heritage Museum. Under the strategic leadership of the Collins Foundation, which in 2013 received the historic collection of late philanthropist Jacques M. Littlefield, the museum was opened in 2019 and has since become a well-known spot for military history aficionados and conducts ongoing research on its world-class collection of authentic tanks, planes, and other equipment from World War II to more recent conflicts. Another speaker, Museum Vice President and Institutional Advancement Ryan Keough, commended co-authors Kevin and Lawrence Wallace for their great research effort. The collection of unknown stories from 317 Purple Heart recipients, prisoners of war, and Gold Star families, calling these stories of courage, patriotism, sacrifice, and perseverance, the museum official noted that such oral histories remind us why preserving firsthand history matters so deeply here at the American Heritage Museum. Mr. Keough also revealed that the Van of Valor presentation is just the first in a projected monthly public lecture series on different topics called History After Hours. The lecture series will be held the first Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Community reflects on meaning of Independence Day through Frederick Douglass Reading by Kristen DeJean. As communities across the country prepared to celebrate Independence Day, local residents gathered on June 27th at Stowe Acres Country Club to examine the nation's founding ideals through the words of abolitionist Frederick Douglass. It was part of a Reading Frederick Douglass Together event hosted by Rediscover Mapledale, which received grants from Mass Humanities and Mass Cultural Council. Let me take a drink of water. That's better. This is the first year that Rediscover Mapledale has participated in the Mass Humanities Program. The events, which take place annually across the state, center on community readings of Douglass's 1852 speech, What to the Slave is the Fourth of July, a speech that challenged Americans to reconcile the celebration of liberty with the reality of slavery. Douglass's speech was written in response to the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which required all U.S. citizens and law enforcement to assist in the capture and return of escaped slaves. It also denied accused runaways the right to a jury trial and subjected anyone aiding them to severe penalties. In his 1852 speech, Douglass focused on the hypocrisy of celebrating freedom as so many remained enslaved. One core aspect of Reading Frederick Douglass Together events is that they involve many readers who read portions of the speech. There were 11 readers at the Rediscover Mapledale event. Historian Sean Osborne opened the afternoon with a presentation titled Liberty Further Extended, Exploring Stories of Freedom, Resilience, and Advocacy Before Leading to the Reading. I am so grateful to all of the readers and guests who came out to this event on behalf of Rediscover Mapledale, said the organization's founder and chair, Kelly Lawler. Reading Frederick Douglass Together is a testament to the kind of love, action, and advocacy that communities have always been capable of when they unite on common ground. After the reading, participants discussed the continuing relevance of Douglass's message, focusing on democracy, civic participation, equality, and the responsibilities of citizenship. The program concluded with words from abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison's poem, The Triumph of Freedom, reinforcing the theme that the pursuit of liberty and equality remains an ongoing responsibility. Among those participating was State Representative Kate Hogan, who later described the experience as different voices, one community, reading Douglass's words together, and called it an important tradition that demonstrated democracy through listening and reflecting on history. Rediscover Mapledale said it hopes to make the pre-Independence Day reading an annual tradition that encourages civic dialogue while connecting the history of the 4th of July with ongoing conversations about freedom, equality, and democracy. The event's location added historical context. Stowe Acres Country Club was established in 1926 by Robert H. Hawkins, a pioneering black businessman who purchased the property and built the original nine-hole golf course. Organizers said the site's history complemented the themes of the gathering. Wetlands, a Crucial Drought Resource, by Melissa Rollins. Those of us who are not as environmentally savvy as we should be may not be familiar with what the term wetlands encompasses, why they are important, and the regulations that surround protecting wetlands. Understanding wetlands is crucial, especially during this critical drought in Massachusetts. Wetlands in Massachusetts include both coastal and inland areas where water is at or just below the surface of the ground. Areas that appear dry during some seasons may still be considered wetlands if they contain water for enough of the year to support certain plants and soils. In Stowe and Bolton, wetlands include marshes, wet meadows, bogs, swamps, and vernal pools. Wetlands are vitally important to people, fish, and wildlife. They provide valuable functions in several ways. When stormwater runoff enters a wetland, Plants slow the water's velocity, and heavy metals and other pollutants may be absorbed in wetland soils and vegetation. Wetland vegetation naturally uses the nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, that, if discharged in excessive amounts, may cause harmful algae blooms and hypoxic or oxygen deficiency zones in larger bodies of water, areas where dissolved oxygen levels drop too low to support most aquatic life. Finally, through natural biological processes, some microorganisms living in wetland soils and sediments break down organic pollutants, pesticides, and toxic runoff. And let's take a break for a public service announcement, and then I'll continue with this article.
Did you know that there are many different ways to listen to Audio Journal? You can go to our website, audiojournal.org, and stream us live. Or you can install the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad. Or you can tell your smart speaker to play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or you can dial us at 1-712-770-1043 on your telephone. Or you can turn on your local cable access TV station. You can check our website, audiojournal.org, for the correct channel for your town. And finally, you can use one of our special receivers tuned to Audio Journal's frequency. And if you missed your favorite program, go to our website or the Audio Journal app and listen to podcasts of previously aired programs. Now, if you need assistance with any of these listening methods, please contact us at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is Bob Brady back with Audio Journal. The time, 3:47. And I'm going to continue with the Stowe and Bolton Independent. I started to read this article about wetlands, and I'll read a little bit more of it. Additionally, according to the EPA, scientists now know that atmospheric maintenance may be an additional wetlands function. Wetlands store carbon within their plant communities and soil instead of releasing it to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. Thus, wetlands help to moderate global climate conditions. Wetlands compare to rainforests and coral reefs in their importance to supporting the ecosystems for microbes, plants, insects, amphibians, reptiles, birds, fish, and mammals. They are a foundational level of our local food web. A wide variety of birds and mammals in our area, from cattails to deer, depend on wetlands for food, water, and shelter. The relationship of the wetland with the larger watershed, the area where all precipitation, like rain and snowmelt, drains downhill into a common body of water, such as a stream, river, or lake, is complex and critical. Volunteer efforts to control invasives and visual progress with water chestnut. Submitted by John San Germano, Stewardship Co-Leader, Stowe Conservation Trust. The Stowe Conservation Trust is the local private nonprofit land trust. The land trust is distinct from the Town of Stowe Conservation Commission. Both organizations work together on initiatives. The Stowe Conservation Trust is volunteer-run and gets all funding from memberships and donations. The Stowe Conservation Trust maintains miles of marked trails and owns 433 acres of land. The Stowe Conservation Trust, SCT, has a long-term focus on controlling invasive plants as part of the organization's mission, protecting land, air, and wildlife. Healthy and resilient forest lands are critical to counter emissions of greenhouse gas like carbon dioxide, CO2. Non-native plants often do not provide food for wildlife and tend to crowd out beneficial habitat. SCT has an ongoing volunteer effort under the name of Stew Crew. Information on volunteering for SCT is available on their website, stoweconservationtrust.org. Stewardship in SCT means caring for the land and trails that are owned and managed. But as well, the SCT Board of Directors sharing stewardship work as an example to residents. What should homeowners do with their own home? A suggestion is for education and awareness of invasive plants. Stop them before they become established. Many people are aware of Japanese knotweed, the tall plant that looks like bamboo. Knotweed has the destructive ability to crack pavement and foundations. The roots spread underground 4 feet or more once established. Simply cutting the above-ground plant one time does not degrade the full plant. If you see one growing, cut it repeatedly and consider herbicide treatment. Do not let it get started. Oriental bittersweet is well known in that you can see this growing and wrapping vines around trees. Given enough time, the weight of the plants will take down trees. Giant hogweed is a new arrival in Massachusetts. Initially, you might be impressed by the 4-plus-foot height, 5-inch leaves, and pretty white flowers. But the sap from the leaves is toxic to skin and will cause painful blisters. This has been seen in Acton, so might be here in Stowe. Tree of Heaven is an aggressive, invasive tree. If you just cut one of these down, the roots will send up sprouts, and you will have 20 trees the following year. This sounds like a mythical hydra dragon, but in real life. The Tree of Heaven also has a bad feature in that it attracts the new invasive insect, spotted lanternfly. The colorful spotted lanternfly has been making its way north, Philadelphia 3 years ago, Providence last year, into southern Massachusetts last year. Once established, this insect will require more control methods for orchards and gardens. During a learning session in Stockbridge in Western Mass, invasive hardy kiwi was noted as worse than all the other invasives in that town. Plants grow up to 20 feet in a year and get up into tree canopies. SCT and water chestnut. Invasive water chestnut became a target for SCT because of the spread of plants in Flag Hill Pond. The pond exists because of an impoundment created in the path of Heath Hen Brook in the 1950s. The pond provides habitat for reptiles and amphibians. Signs of this can be found from mammals like otters that have eaten freshwater mollusks, clams. The pond is central to an area of conserved, private, and open land. To the west is the town Heath Hen Meadow Brook parcel. To the north, the SCT Surrey parcel and the town Flag Hill area. The brook flows across Shelburne Farm, down South Acton Road, and eventually to the Assabet and Concord Rivers. Volunteers have been pulling water chestnut for 9 years. This turned what had been about 65% cover of plants to less than 35%. Water chestnut leafy surface blooms block sunlight to the plants and critters that live in the water. Without sunlight, a condition called eutrophication results. Oxygen is depleted and the pond can die. Before and current photographs below of the pond surface are telling the progress. I know you can't see them, but one has a lot of weeds, the other not many. To control water chestnut, volunteers pull up the plant from a kayak or boat and fill laundry baskets with the pulled, nasty-looking nut and plant. Full baskets are emptied on land and composted. To volunteers, the work is fun and rewarding. After working an area, the water is free of the plants. It is sometimes hard to stop work as you want to keep going and filling one more basket. Stowe Conservation Trust Bike for the Woods team, gearing up. Submitted by Jim Salvi. Year after year, the Bike for the Woods ride through Stowe and surrounding towns raises money to support the Stowe Conservation Trust efforts to protect forests and farms. Last year's event hosted 130 riders and raised about $3,500 for the nonprofit, soon celebrating its 50th anniversary. The 2026 Bike for the Woods will take place on Sunday, August 9th. Families with young children might be particularly interested in the 5-mile course, while the 14, 25, and 37-mile courses are a little hillier and more appropriate for experienced adult riders. For those looking for a challenge, there's a fun, hilly metric century course of 64 miles. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you'd like a hard copy of our program schedule in large print or braille, call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available at audiojournal.org. This is Bob Brady. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. When wildlife conservationist Olya Weekly was a little kid, she noticed something incredible from her apartment window.
I was born and raised in Ukraine, and we were living on the third floor, and in the corner of our window in the kitchen, every year house martins came and made a mud nest.
House martins are a kind of swallow that breed across much of Europe. They construct an enclosed nest from mud and spit, often under the eaves of homes and city buildings.
And my grandma would be furious because they would just make a whole big mess on the glass. And she would grumble about it and be like, oh, these darn house martins. But at the same time, we both would be glued to them and watching the parents come and feed the babies and seeing the little yellow baby mouths sticking out. And then eventually we could see each one of them leave the nest and then we would wait for them to come back the next year.
Today in Arizona, Olya leads the Nest Box program at Tucson Bird Alliance, which designs nest boxes for desert birds and helps people create nesting opportunities at home.
It's super special to be able to sit and watch their behaviors in the nest box, on an open cup nest, even in the window of your third floor apartment.
For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.
What's your vision?
My vision's 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye and zero vision in the left eye.
20/200 at best on my left eye, and on my right eye, I cannot.
No, I mean, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
My vision is employment opportunities for all, including people with disabilities.
My vision is for all of my students to dream big.
That he become fully independent.
For my patients to live their best lives.
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
What is your vision?
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, our vision is clear. We believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/mcb.